On Wednesday, February 11th, 2026, the group Montana Together sponsored a panel discussion about immigrants and immigration law enforcement in Gallatin Valley, featuring Bozeman Public Schools Superintendent Casey Bertram, migrant advocate Marcus Pearson of the nonprofit advocacy group Bienvenidos, Bozeman Chief of Police Jim Veltkamp, and Gallatin County Attorney Audrey Cromwell. Chandra Wolf moderated. The event was held at the Bozeman Public Library. There was a question and answer session following the panel discussion, but KGVM recorded only the main discussion. As a reminder, the opinions expressed by this panel are not those necessarily of KGVM, its board, or its volunteers.
Good evening, folks. A little bit about me. My name is Chandra. I'm part of a very grassroots organization. Thanks, guys! Doing this for free, okay? I'm part of a very grassroots organization here called Montana Together, and I know all of you have probably been experiencing this a bit too. There's a lot of silos of information, a lot of rumors, a lot of misinformation. So a little bit about me before we go to our expert panel. I'm a Gallatin resident for over 20 years. I'm a mom, I'm a wife, but most importantly, I'm a Montana State Bobcat. And I don't know if you guys know this. We're national champions, so thanks for indulging me on that, you guys, because we got to set a little levity before we go into the heavy hitters here. I appreciate all of you coming. Again, there's a lot of uncertainty, and many in our community are feeling anxious and concerned, and so tonight is about meeting those fears with facts. And we also brought together some really great speakers here to talk about how our educators are supporting all of our students, how our local law enforcement operates, what are your constitutional rights, what resources exist to support our community, and how we as a community can care for each other. I personally am not a lawyer. I'm not an educator. And I definitely think I know everything, but that is not the case. So, great news. We have an amazing panel here. We have Casey Bertram, who's our superintendent of Bozeman Public Schools. We have Marcus Pearson, who is a board member at Bienvenidos. We have Chief Jim Veltkamp of the Bozeman Police. And we also have one of my number one county attorneys at Gallatin here, Audrey Cromwell. You guys will see me stand out over her a little bit. So I'm going to get right into it, and we're going to kind of break it down into these topics of education, of community support, of Jim, Chief Veltkamp's expertise, and then Audrey will talk about citizens' rights. So Casey, starting with you, can you just share with us the Bozeman Public Schools procedures regarding ICE?
Yeah, thank you for being here. Thank you for, most importantly, for caring about this topic, but I think broadly caring about our immigrant population in our community. They say they can't hear me.
I think that we've had a lot of questions around why aren't your policies or procedures related to immigration enforcement widely published on your website. I think that I hope you understand that any topic that has any sort of political connotation and is building political rhetoric around the country, we serve all students. And when we publish those things, we hear from the far left, we hear from the far right, and we hear negativity, and it takes our eye off the ball of serving the students and the families that are within our schools. But I do want to assure you that we've had, about a year ago, let me back up a little bit, about a year ago, there was a change in some policy at the federal level, Department of Homeland Security, all the uproar about schools no longer being safe spaces for immigration enforcement. So it was at that time, we weren't seeing any immigration enforcement anywhere near our schools, but it was at that time we got with our attorneys, got with national organizations that represent schools and school boards, and built out our policy and procedures around that. And so it, in a nutshell, they're not a secret. I'm happy to walk you through all of it. We just don't widely publish it on our website.
Can you talk a little bit about your statement that you recently put out? I think that might be helpful too.
Yeah. So I think there are people here that want to know, like, what would exactly happen. And we have a very specific protocol. We recently updated this, retrained all of our administration team. But in a nutshell, if there was attempted immigration enforcement activity on or near a public school under my watch in Bozeman Public Schools, it's an immediate call to the superintendent and deputy superintendents, as well as our SRO team. So we have four school resource officers and an SRO sergeant. We would go to that school and engage with any immigration official. Part of that process is asking for identification, making copies of identification, asking for warrants, court orders, subpoenas, working with our legal counsel to verify that it's an actual warrant, court order, or subpoena. If all of those pieces of the puzzle are in place, there would be an attempt to have some logical conversations about why are we doing this at a public school? And are there other ways to handle whatever that warrant, corner, and subpoena is so that we don't interrupt the safe educational space for all students? At that time, we would begin recording all those conversations, video and audio, so that we have a record of what happened in those rooms. And then ultimately, if there was some legally mandated immigration enforcement of an individual within our school district, we would do that in the most discreet manner that doesn't interrupt the educational learning environment. I think we've also provided a lot of guidance to our administrative team around directory information, around Plyer versus Doe, around all of the pieces of the puzzle that we don't collect immigration information on any of our students. Even if we had a governmental entity wanting that, we don't have it. And if we did have it, it's protected under FERPA and require another court order, subpoena, or legal action that way. So in a nutshell, we do have policies or procedures. I'm really hoping this evening that I can tell more of the story about a beautiful population in our community that needs a lot of support.
Do you want me to go into the next question?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes, that would be helpful. Yes.
How can we support students who might be experiencing some fear to attend school in our broader,
yeah,
all of our students?
I think there's some assurances that I think what has happened over the past 2 weeks is we have a lot of people who care, and we had some well-intentioned white people in our community that care deeply that caused some hysteria with some of our immigrant community that was not founded on factual information. We've calmed that down thanks to your support, thanks to a lot of other people's support, and we've got most of those students and their families back to school and back to work. There's a handout that you can pick up later that sort of tells the story of this growing immigrant population in our community. And we've gone from a school district of less than 100 students, less than 2% of our population, and over a 10-year period, now we're approaching 10% of our population. Right now, 569 multilingual English learners. The vast majority of them are immigrant families. Vast majority of them are Spanish-speaking. And so about 500% increase in our school district. With that comes a lot of beautiful opportunities and a lot of challenges. What we know about our immigrant population, I don't want to paint anyone with broad strokes, but we see a high prevalence of trauma factors from their origin countries on their journey here, and then while they are here. We also see incredible barriers for our families in the community that simple things like free and reduced lunch that's guaranteed to all of our students based on income eligibility. If I'm an immigrant family and on that piece of paper that's a governmental piece of paper from a federal food service program, I have to put my name, I have to put my address, I have to put my income, I have to put my place of work, those pieces of the puzzle. So there's real and tangible barriers where we are approaching close to $100,000 in lunch debt. We feed all kids every day, but we have lunch debt. The largest percentage of that lunch debt is from our multilingual English learner families. Access to food is one thing. Access to housing is another thing. Access to mental health supports, even within our district, we're one of two states that doesn't have any state-level funding for multilingual English learner supports. It's Montana and Mississippi. It's not a list that you want to be on. And so we receive about a $39,000 grant annually from the federal government, Title III. Yet as a district, we've prioritized resources for these families and are spending close to $1 million on staffing and all the things that go with it. Going from a one-person shop, if you know Ellen, who was at the Wilson for a lot of years, to now about 10 FTE, and we're only at the tip of the iceberg. If we did the recommended number of hours that these students deserve, constitutionally guaranteed to them to learn English within our schools, we'd need a 400% increase in staffing and budget. And so we're doing all we can, and part of my messaging is we have an immigration enforcement issue that brought a lot of people here tonight, but we've had an immigrant support issue in this community for 10 years. And I thank you for being here.
Thank you. And I think just to revisit the, are there any additional measures being taken to ensure school safety and how immigration enforcement would possibly impact procedures, like, for example, a bus transfer or something?
Yeah, I think that this moment in time caused some unneeded panic, but it also brought together a lot of agencies that communicate sometimes, and we've had some really robust conversations. So I've had a great sit down with the executive director of Bean and Venitos. I've been in closer contact with, we have great contact daily with our SRO team and our sergeant, but leadership at the city and leadership in the police department, sheriff's department, various organizations within the community. I think that's all been positive. In terms of safety at our schools, schools are never safe enough, and we have some very tangible opportunities. I see Virginia in the room, so we have a great partnership with Thrive, where we have mentors placed in our schools as CAP pals. Every extra adult we put in our schools is an extra set of eyes that has conversations and can notice things and see kids who are sad or dejected or things that are alarming or seemingly unsafe. We also, in all of our schools now, have a Project Connect group that is just there to engage with kids, but it's also, we only have X number of staff. We can't be everywhere. And so before and after school, recess, hallways, lunchrooms, Project Connect volunteers are just to be another caring adult that's helping a kid cross the street, that's opening a door for students, but it's also getting a bunch of community members in our schools, and so that their image and their picture in their mind when they think about public education in Bozeman is painted by public education in Bozeman and not what they're seeing on whatever news cycle they're watching.
And I think there's a lot of parents in here as well, as myself included. How can we help lift our educators and our principals who are serving a diverse audience of students? Just lift them up as they navigate these procedures and ICE.
Yeah, I think it's part of the, you take it on when you become a public educator. Your inbox fills with people who have concerns, and your inbox rarely fills with people that said, you nailed it today, thanks for being you. And so I think that when you think about our educators, we used to, because of smaller numbers of multilingual English learners, we did some sort of newcomer sites, and so there was a growing population at Gallatin High School and at Sacagawea Middle School at Highlight Elementary. Now it doesn't matter what elementary, middle, or high school you go, there's a growing population of multilingual English learners. So they're in all of our classrooms, which means for some of our teachers, they're having to reimagine how they design instruction, make it accessible to not only students with disabilities, students with reading and learning challenges, but now students who don't speak English as their primary language and may have just arrived in the country. On that handout, what we also know about our immigrant population in our schools is this term SLIFE, which is significant limited or interrupted formal education. And so we have a lot of students who through their journey have missed large chunks of the education process, and then they show up at Bozeman High School and they're in Algebra 2. And how do we make that all work? So I think what our teachers, administrators need right now is compassion. They need a hug. They need a pat on the back. They need support when you think about supporting public education. They need advocacy at the state level in terms of funding formulas. They need all of those things. But most importantly, I think they need to know that you see them and that you care about them.
Thank you so very much. I think it is really important what Casey mentioned, too. I think it's really easy to criticize. I think it's really hard to lift people up. And our educators are under immense pressure. And there's constant landscapes that are changing. So thank you guys all for being here for that. Marcus with Bienvenidos, thanks so much for coming. Let's give Bienvenidos a big round of applause. I think I would love to talk about resources. Can you tell us, Marcus, what resources exist right now in Bozeman for families who are concerned or needs support from our particular immigrant population and just whatever you think is appropriate?
It's a great and very broad question.
Yes.
I'll introduce myself really briefly, as I know some of you, but not all of you. I'm Marcus Pearson. I'm a board member at Bienvenidos here in town. I'm also a lawyer, but I'm not going to speak as a lawyer tonight. I'm speaking as a board member of Bienvenidos. And stepping back a little bit, I do want to acknowledge that we have our executive director and some staff in this room right now. And our amazing executive director, Vanessa Zamora, is a much more eloquent speaker than I am, was pegged to speak, but doesn't feel comfortable speaking in public right now. Because of the amount of fear and the amount of safety considerations that she has to take into account, because though she is a citizen here and has lived here for several years, feels and has been targeted. So I'm stepping in. I'll do my best. I will not do as well as she does normally, but I will do everything that I can to get some solid information to you all. So a bit of background about Bienvenidos first. We were founded in 2019, and it's actually really timely that I'm following Casey here, because we were founded in 2019 really with a focus on the growing multilingual English learning population here in the Gallatin Valley. I'm not going to give numbers because Casey already did, but we've seen an exponential growth in the amount of multilingual English learners here in the Valley over the past 7 years. And Bienvenidos was formed and continues to have a major part of our core mission be to welcome newcomers, whether it's students or their families, and now increasingly both, and to help families navigate life here in Bozeman and in Montana. When folks arrive to a community like Bozeman, it's a very welcoming community, but it can also be a community that is full of challenges. If you don't speak English as a first language, if you have not had access to or know that there are resources out there for you to be able to utilize so that your family, your children, your spouse, your partner, your friends, your community can have greater levels of support and acknowledge and know that there are other organizations in the community that are doing great specific work. And we see ourselves really as a connector to a lot of those communities and to a lot of those organizations that exist, many of whom are in here tonight. So I just want to extend a thank you and give a round of applause to all the organizations that are doing fantastic work in this valley. And so a major part of our program work has always been focusing on building belonging and stability for families and students in the Valley. And so I'll talk a little bit about those resources and what those are. One is that we have youth and family programs. We also have English education as a new program wing that's been stood up recently. We do offer financial assistance and emergency support to families in need for specific issues. Broadly speaking, we offer support around resource navigation and referrals. What does that mean? Resource navigation is, who do I need to talk to? How do I need to talk to them? What are the words? What are the phrases? What are the resources I need to access as a parent in order to make sure that my child has the ability to thrive in school? as a person in order to ensure that I have the ability to go to a dentist or to find an attorney for whatever needs might arise. And increasingly, over the past year and a half, we've seen those needs are really focused on immigration issues here in the Valley. So in addition to those programs, and I'll talk a little bit more about immigration issues in the Valley, but we do have what's called a community closet, which is effectively an open space for our community members to come where they can access diapers, clothing, children's clothes, small food pantry, and seasonally we also have a winter clothing drive so that newly arrived families who might be very confused about the fact that it gets to normally negative 20 here in the wintertime can have access to warm clothes and keep themselves warm and safe during the winter. I guess to step back a little bit about resources for families who are concerned and our community members who are concerned, we have a vast array of resources, right? But I do want to call out some things that we are seeing right now and some of the issues that are causing some of that fear, as well as ensuring that we're minimizing the amount of misinformation that does spread around our communities very quickly because, as Casey said, there are many well-meaning people. The internet is very full of misinformation these days, and it's very easy to get to a place where our executive director is fielding 150 calls a day from people who are concerned about whether they can go out of the house or not. From folks who can ask what they can or can't do. Those are all very well-meaning, helpful questions to ask, but with a small staff, we're being really inundated with what's going on in this community. So I just wanted to highlight that social media misinformation can spread really, really quickly when people are scared. We've seen this all the time. We've seen this not, this isn't isolated to Bozeman, it's not isolated to the United States in 2026. Fear equals misinformation, and misinformation and disinformation fuel more fear. And so the best way to combat that is to have good information, verify your sources. As a lawyer, verifying your sources is very important. And also avoiding inadvertently sharing misinformation broadly, because as we've seen, students for several weeks were scared to go to classes, and people were scared to go out to their office whether it was an office job or elsewise. We're scared to go to work, and so that also includes missing medical appointments. Right, if someone is scared to go out in public, they may not go to get necessary appointments, and those decisions oftentimes increase vulnerability even further because it further isolates community members from the resources that they need. I'm going way beyond your question, so I'm going to stop for a second.
It's okay. It's as if you read the questions that I shared with you guys in advance, so I'm excited to see they're paying attention. I am going to ask you, this will be the most lawyer question I ask you, though, Marcus.
Okay.
Is there a pro bono or low-cost legal service available for folks? And I've got a few things in the background on the side, but do you have any recommendations there, too?
So, yes, is the short answer. The long answer is yes, pro bono or low bono legal services are available in Montana. It's incredibly limited. We have, I think, 5 immigration attorneys in the entire state. I'll let that sink in for a second. Just in Gallatin Valley, we have upwards of 600 students in the schools, and we have 5 immigration attorneys serving the entire state of Montana. That being said, we have a couple of groups that we really highly recommend. If you attended a talk a couple months ago, 2 of those attorneys were here. One was with Big Sky Immigration Law, which was recently stood up and provides low bono immigration services as well as regular cost immigration services. Many of our community members also do have access to attorneys and in a limited way, Bienvenidos has provided some support to those families through various different ways we connect families directly with immigration attorneys for asylum purposes, for visa purposes, and otherwise to allow them to navigate the legal system here. That being said, the legal system has gotten a lot more challenging since January 20th, 2025. That Audrey can speak to that, I think, with way more clarity than I can. All that to say, though, is that any of the legal avenues that people are able to look at or walk down now are increasingly fraught and very complicated. And so wait lists are very common for many families in this community and statewide. And so I would say if there's any way to reduce the amount of uncertainty and wait lists that or waiting time that many of the families are required to do, I would highly recommend looking at Big Sky Immigration Law and other attorneys who are doing low bono work who can support higher numbers of families here.
Thank you so much. I have one more question, because again, you talked a little bit about what might prevent people from accessing help. Is there something that we didn't talk about, just misinformation or fear? Is transportation, is that a need? Maybe something that folks can leave here with today, knowing there's like, these are the two things we really need at Bienvenidos.
Sure, that's a great question. We actually have a really extensive volunteer network. So another way to get involved in a more meaningful way is to volunteer at Bienvenidos. We have dozens of volunteers throughout the community that are working directly with families to help them get them access to those services that are critical. One volunteer, for example, recently helped someone navigate getting a driver's license at the DMV, not only by ensuring that they are prepared, but also saying, hey, you know, your windshield is cracked. And if you go to the DMV with a cracked windshield, normally that wouldn't be an issue. But because we're at a state of heightened risk right now, I'd recommend getting your windshield fixed. Took that person down to safety light or whatever the glass, you know, Jiffy glass. I haven't gotten my windshield fixed in a while. I have a big crack.
Jiffy glass is not a real place. Just to let everybody know, that's not a real place. Yeah,
I'm not saying we should support any particular glass repair shop. Let's just say just generic glass repair shop, and was able to get that window fixed so that the person could go to the DMV and pass their driver's test. And so if there's a sense of helplessness within this room or hopelessness, action is next to love, probably the best way to push back against hate and fear. And so I would encourage folks, if you're interested and have the capacity and capability, to look into volunteering your time and efforts, because community members and the community that Bienvenida serves is always needing to have that reassurance that they can go to the dentist, that if they go to a dentist for an appointment, it's going to be a place where they're going to feel welcome. And that, at the end of the day, is the critical component of what we do as an organization.
Thank you so much, Marcus. Thanks, Bienvenidos. So I'd like to thank Chief Veltkamp for coming in and spending additional time here to add some clarity and help us with the facts. I've seen him speak at a couple events now, and he does a really great job of ensuring that our community is safe, everybody feels heard, and I think you've done a really great job navigating the protests, and I just want to thank you for that, because it takes a lot to show up. So. Can you just help us as a community understand what is the Bozeman Police Department's policy regarding immigration enforcement?
Absolutely. So thank you for having me. If I haven't met you yet, I'm Jim Veltkamp. I'm the chief of police here. I've been with the department for about 27 years, which seems like a long time when I say it. Been the chief for about five. So we do have an immigration policy. I was going to say, what's our policy? And I was going to say, well, it's number 414, and see if that helped anybody. But I do not know that. I know that wouldn't. Yes, it is a published policy. So we do have all of our policies on our website. Unfortunately, this one is still going through some process to be put on the website. Years ago, our policies were intended more for the officers to know what to do and what not to do. Quite a few years ago now, that kind of shifted. So the officers need to obviously follow the guidance of the policies, but we also believe it's important that the public be able to see those policies. So these are intentionally not written just for a patrol officer to understand, but hopefully for every community member to understand. So once it does get published, I believe actually it was ADA compliance that was holding it up getting published, ironically. So hopefully, yeah, it's the lawyers. She said it, not me. So hopefully soon it will be out there. As far as what our policy regarding immigration is, it's honestly pretty simple. It is not our job. So we truly believe that we should not be forced into helping enforce immigration violations, but we should also not be prohibited from at least communicating with those whose job it is to do it. Regardless of how you feel about it, we need to know what's going on in our own town. We work with all kinds of different agencies all the time, which I'm going to try to save for the next question.
Thank you.
But we need to be able to communicate, interact, and be aware what is going on in our community. So our policy essentially reads, public safety is our focus. The investigation of crime is our job. What that means is it doesn't matter your immigration status. Our job is to keep safe every member of the community, anybody passing through town, anybody who's lived here for five generations. It doesn't matter. Our job is to investigate crime, enhance public safety, and keep people safe. So what that means is officers are told, not only in this policy, but in multiple other policies, treat everyone equally, regardless. So if we get a call, let me back up. We want to be sure that victims feel safe coming to report crime to us. We have some pretty hideous crimes that happen that do involve people who are undocumented who are here. Our job is to investigate them exactly the same. So we need victims to feel safe coming forward and talking with us. I'm aware there are plenty of barriers to that, and we need to continue doing our part to break down those barriers, but immigration enforcement is not our job. So our policy very clearly states officers are to investigate crime regardless of immigration status. If they would normally have taken that person to the detention center to arrest them regardless of immigration status. If they would have issued a citation and you can identify them, issue a citation exactly like you normally would. If this is something you would have probably warned them for and just let them go, do that. So we don't take adverse or different enforcement action based on your immigration status or not being able to know what your status is. That sounds simple, but honestly, it gets a lot more complicated. I consistently think of the police officers out there who are trying to abide by this policy, are aware that if they don't take action when they should have, many people are going to be upset at them. If they take action when they shouldn't have, unless that's what I just said, if they do the opposite, the community is going to be upset at them. So they are very conscious of this, and I promise you they deal with this on a daily basis. I've also had questions about what are they going to do when this happens here or if this happens here. It happens every day already. So the fact that we have not had a bad situation occur here tells me that they are doing a phenomenal job dealing with an extremely complicated issue on a daily basis. Here's one example. If someone commits a crime, commits a pretty substantial theft, and it is normally something we would have issued a citation for, but we can't identify the person, so we don't know if they're here legally or not, what do we do? Are we supposed to issue a citation to the name that they gave us and let them go? Now we have a community member who's a victim of a crime, and we didn't do our job to identify who they were. You can see those types of scenarios make it very complicated. And so there's a lot more variables in here where we have to allow them some discretion in those kinds of situations. Typically, if they can't identify them, like I said, handle it how you normally would. If you can't identify them, then they may need to take additional steps to identify who this person is. So that's essentially our policy. Again, it's relatively short compared to some others, just because it's pretty clear that it is not our job. We are to keep the community safe, investigate crime, and not worry about immigration status. That even goes down to a traffic stop. If you stop somebody, how long to try to identify who they are? So there's a lot of variables in there, but that's the basics of our policy.
Thank you, Chief Feldkamp. Can you just share the distinction between a local police officer and a federal immigration ICE agent?
Sure. So something we commonly face in our job as law enforcement officers is that communities generally see us all the same, right? So if one police officer on the other side of the country with a completely different role screws up, every police officer is looked at sideways. It's just part of the job, especially due to the nature of the job. I wouldn't say the privileges, but we are given a lot of responsibility, and so that we take that part of that responsibility on. It has kind of, I've never seen this in 27 years, where it seems like people are actually understanding a distinction between federal agents, ICE agents certainly right now, local law enforcement. I've never seen that before where we haven't been all lumped together with the worst actor. So that's very unique to us. So I work for the city of Bozeman. My paycheck says city of Bozeman. My jurisdiction is in the city of Bozeman. A Gallatin County Sheriff's Deputy, it's kind of in the name, but they work for Gallatin County. So very similar duties to us, couple differences. They do some civil work that we don't. We handle crashes, car crashes, which they don't. Their checks say Gallatin County. Montana Highway Patrol, state of Montana. So they do crashes across the state, but generally not in the cities. So those are what we would say the state and local law enforcement. Outside of that, there are a huge number of federal agencies, a lot of whom employ special agents. So we all know about the FBI agents, maybe the DEA agents. But beyond that, there are many, many other agents. And I just want to mention that in my 27 years here, I have worked with so many different types of special agents that have come through Bozeman. If we've worked on a specific type of crime together, the community has generally not noticed. So in that way, they've always been here. There are U.S. Postal Service inspectors and investigators stationed in the state of Montana. We've worked with IRS special investigative agents. Name your agency, they're there. So a lot of federal agencies have special agents and some kind of law enforcement branch within their organization. So ICE is under Department of Homeland Security, or DHS. Look up their org chart, and it is massive. Everything from TSA that you see at the airport to a huge wide variety of agencies. And each of them has their own specific mission and thing that they are supposed to do. I can't speak to them, and I don't even know every mission and what they all do. But clearly, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, is a branch of Department of Homeland Security tasked with specific duties. The Border Patrol is a separate piece of Department of Homeland Security, and kind of in their name, Border Patrol, they are tasked with a little bit different duties. So they have very focused duties and tasks, completely different than local law enforcement, and they operate and have different authority under the federal code and not under the state of Montana codes. So, for example, immigration violations, some are criminal and some are civil, but they're all federal violations. We don't investigate any civil or administrative actions or violations. We do criminal, but we don't do federal. That's up to them. We enforce state of Montana law and every once in a while city of Bozeman ordinances.
Just to kind of reemphasize this, because I think it is good clarity, is so what is the safest and most reliable way for a member of the public to verify that someone claiming to be a federal ICE agent is in fact a legitimate federal officer?
Sure. So I'll go a little bit broader on that. Conveniently or not conveniently, I was gone the last 2.5 weeks when a lot of this really kicked off, and that was not in the plan. But I was out of the country and missed a lot of it.
You are allowed to go on holiday. It's okay.
Sometimes it doesn't feel like it. But sometimes, or during that time, I heard a lot of stories and situations about community members believing they saw ICE or following a vehicle. So it's been mentioned here already, but there is a lot of fear, and I do understand the fear, but the vast, vast majority of it is simply not true. I drive an unmarked silver Ford Explorer, that is my department car. Every once in a while, I pull somebody over looking like this if I really see him run a bad red light. But it gives me pause right now to make a traffic stop in my unmarked car. I want to say, I'm Bozeman Police. It's okay. I'm the Bozeman Police. So we have seen a lot of that lately. Our joint city-county SWAT team was training the other day, and they were camo. We had signs out that said BPD training in progress, and people were standing there filming them. And they said, we're Bozeman police officers. We're practicing clearing buildings. So we've had a lot of fear that way. It has not happened here. And we are in conversations constantly with various federal agencies to make sure we have our finger on the pulse of what could or may ever happen here. So right now, it is not happening. I just want to say that. For what officers respond to in the field, they routinely respond to a call where once they get there, they have to determine if what's happening is legitimate or not, kind of like they would have to with ICE. So here's just one example. At the bars at night, somebody calls and reports that one person put handcuffs on another person and pulled them out of the bar. Is that legitimate? We don't know. Quite often it's a bail bondsman who is not marked in any way, shape, or form. We get reports of car theft. Somebody just stole my car in the middle of the night. You know what our first question is? How far behind are you on your payments? Because quite often it's the legal repo man. So you expand that out where our officers are consistently responding to something where they're not sure when they arrive if it's going to be legitimate or not. So I believe they fully understand that if they got a call for something like this, they would respond the same and try to determine whether the people who were saying they're ICE agents, whether they are valid or not. Backing up a second again, the reason we need to be able to communicate about what is going on in our community and if any federal agents are here is the last thing we want is for a bad action between our officers and some federal agents. That would be absolutely disastrous. So if we can communicate with them, and I'm talking about federal agencies overall, at least we know what's going on in our community. We can communicate. We can know if we get that 911 call, oh, that must be this operation. We know that's legitimate, and we can respond appropriately. So if and when that happens, I have not seen any federal agents that refuse to identify themselves, and I can only speak for Bozeman because it's the only place I've ever worked in law enforcement. I have not seen that happen. As far as masks, as far as all the other stuff, again, that's federal agents don't have to abide by a lot of local preferences or local ordinances, and I don't want to speak for them and some of the choices and things that they've done. I just don't think that's appropriate. If you have a concern about someone else, I would say do not attempt to intervene. Call 911. Let us respond, and we will handle it. The worst thing that can happen is people try to get involved themselves, sometimes with good intentions, and that just doesn't go well. It's the same thing as I would tell somebody if you're seeing a fight on the street or somebody driving that you believe is drunk. Be a good observer, note the facts, call 911, and let us respond.
Thank you so very much.
Could I jump in really quickly?
Yeah,
if possible?
Please do.
Because this is one additional area where well-meaning people might want to call bienvenidos in a case like that. We want to really reiterate, 911 is the best emergency hotline we've got. We're not a 24-hour emergency hotline as an organization. Chief Veldkamp has spoken extensively with our staff and with our executive director and is well aware that that 911 as an emergency hotline is the place to go to either report something that you've seen or if you or a family member are feeling unsafe or if the officers aren't identifying themselves, any of the issues that Chief Veldkamp just mentioned. Bienvenidos is here as a support system. We can't be emergency responders as well as all the other things that we do, but we have a great emergency response system right here in the city of Bozeman.
Thank you. And just one final question for you, Chief Veldkamp. When does local law enforcement engage with federal agents?
We do it all the time. So we have, like I said, a wide variety of agencies that come through town. To be honest, not a whole lot of them have a presence in Bozeman, mainly because we've grown so fast. There's a presence in all the major cities of some agency or another. But we deal with federal agencies consistently. So we have to partner with them for a lot of different crimes. I worked on the task force here for 7 years, and we had members of various federal agencies assigned to us, the DEA agents that really helped get the cases going through the federal system quicker. I don't have the ability to write drug crimes or drug cases into federal court. They do. So we deal with them on a daily basis. I would say near daily basis. I take that back. On a wide variety of things. They bring so much sometimes funding, but also so much different authority, so many other tools. We deal with them in some of the most serious crimes that we have in town, whether these are sex crimes involving children, whether it's human trafficking, whether it's some of the violent crime, especially with violent crime involving some kind of gang. And we have had some transnational gang members in town committing some of our biggest crimes. We absolutely need the partnership and support of federal agencies. So again, this is nothing new, having federal agencies or agents in town, but the direction, some of the behaviors, some of the things going on are certainly different than what we've seen in the past.
Thank you very much, Chief. I appreciate it. I would encourage people to look. Yes, let's give them. Come on. And I see people very hot. If anyone's wondering, this is not a breathable fabric, this sweatshirt. It is not a breathable fabric. I would encourage people to research and look up Dan Springer, our sheriff, the U.S. Marshal, and just look at their policies as well. The sheriff is an elected position, and I just think educating ourselves on the different roles and responsibilities is something I would encourage. Best for last, no offense, guys. Audrey Cromwell, our Gallatin County attorney, guys. Like I said, I'm a big fan. Okay. Can you talk about what Gallatin County's policy is regarding immigration enforcement from your law lens?
Yes, absolutely. Hi, everybody. My name is Audrey Cromwell. I'm your elected Gallatin County attorney. I want to just start off by saying that I feel really proud of my community right now to see all of you here, even though there's fear. Looking for the facts is how we're going to move through challenges as a community. And I'm just really proud that all of you are here, so thank you. All right, like Marcus and Chief Vilcamp stated, federal ICE immigration enforcement is a federal construct, and it's typically a civil issue. So our local law enforcement is not authorized by statute to participate in any kind of enforcement unless there is an agreement or a memorandum of understanding between the entity and the federal government. So the only area that the county has agreed to participate in any kind of immigration enforcement is through a 287G agreement. This is an agreement that Sheriff Gutkin back in 2020 entered into with the Department of Homeland Security to allow individual officers to serve administrative warrants when someone has been detained in our detention center. So what that looks like from a logistical sense is that someone is arrested, like Chief Vilcamp said, you know, if someone would be arrested, they would be taken to the detention center. And then at that point, their information is put through an ICE database. And if it comes back that that individual is undocumented, then there are a couple of detention officers that are trained and authorized to serve that administrative warrant. And at that point, if the individual was going to be released from the detention center, either on bond or after a sentence, the detention center can hold that individual up to 48 hours, and they alert ICE, and ICE can make a determination about whether or not they want to pick that individual up. It's not mandatory. We have seen a rather large jump since last January, 2025. I have some updated statistics, and I think it is 86 people that are currently in the detention center that have an administrative warrant attached to them. So let's say that someone is arrested and it's a felony and they're committed to the Department of Corrections, so the prison or Montana State Prison for 20 years. That administrative warrant would follow that individual until they're released in 20 years. This is, I think, where we are seeing the most immigration enforcement in our community is through this 287G program. Like Chief Elkamp said, local law enforcement is not authorized to arrest people for civil immigration. That's not something that our local law enforcement does.
Thank you. I also informed myself of this. So can you talk to us a little bit about Montana House Bill 278 and what are the implications locally? And Chief Elkamp, if you have anything to add from the learning the bills, guys. Get afraid.
So Montana House Bill 278 was a bill that was passed this last legislative session and then signed into law by Governor Gianforte. It took effect in October of 2025. And what it does is it adds a section, Section 3, to our Montana Code about investigative stop and frisk. It's 46-5-401, so now it's codified, and anyone can look it up, a Montana Code annotated. And what it allows is a peace officer who has lawfully stopped a person, so it has to be a lawful stop, may make a reasonable attempt upon reasonable suspicion and when practicable to determine the immigration status of a person, unless it hinders or obstructs an investigation. And my understanding is that during the legislature, this was changed from a mandatory requirement to a may, right? And so what my understanding is, and I'm going to turn this over to Chief Elkamp to talk about what Bozeman Police Department does, is that this is an individual determination based on the individual agency about whether or not they are going to do this.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to follow up on that. I said this last time, but when this bill originally came out, it said that we will determine the immigration status or take steps. This will surprise you, but the Montana Police Protective Association, which is a statewide organization of all police officers, and I'm on the board of the Montana Association Chiefs of Police, MACOP, we lobbied against that because of the, for multiple reasons, but can you imagine the bind that that puts officers in? You stop a car. Now, if you think they're here possibly and they're undocumented, you have to check. Based on what? Based on what kind of discriminatory factors are you taking into account? And we did not feel that that was appropriate. And so at least the bill was changed to say may. The next question, which most of you are thinking, is, so what are you guys doing about that? So I'm going to jump ahead and answer that. To be honest, we are doing nothing about it. When we write a policy that says you won't do that, it goes on top of that because it says you may. And so we don't want any officers taking those additional steps just to identify who they are unless a crime has taken place, and then they can't identify them, and they have a duty to figure out who committed this crime.
And just for some information about the legal landscape, there has been a lawsuit filed against this particular section already. It's pending in Lewis and Clark County. And the last that I looked, there was a motion to dismiss filed by the state of Montana, and the judge has not yet made a ruling. So that's where the procedural posture is on that particular case. There are similar laws on the books around the country, and some of them have been upheld. So we're just going to kind of have to see how it plays out in Montana, I think.
Switching gears a little bit, let's just talk kind of through some guidance here. If ICE shows up at someone's door in Gallatin County, what legally should they be doing?
So I'm going to preface this by saying that I am no one's lawyer, and I'm not giving legal advice. However, I can just kind of talk generally about some options that an individual would have. So if I can say this, if ICE has a judicial warrant, and it is a warrant signed by a judge, and when I say judge, I mean a federal judge, typically, you could be charged with obstruction if you do not allow that individual into the private area, so your home, for example. If ICE does not have a judicial warrant and they say they have a warrant and it's an administrative warrant, then that's a different story. Administrative warrants do not allow federal officers to come into someone's private space or private home. If ICE comes to your door, a federal agent comes to your door and says they have a warrant, there are some questions that everybody can ask. One, is it signed by a judge? And there are some handouts in the back that look like this. It just shows the difference between a judicial warrant versus an immigration warrant. There are a lot of really important distinctions, and I would encourage you, this is also on the National Immigration Law Center website. There's some pretty important distinctions here, but you can always ask what court issued it, what judge signed it, what is the case number, what is it authorizing. And I want to point out that there are warrants that come from other places, right? So I sign warrants all the time. Chief L. Camp's officers sign warrants all the time. The judges sign warrants all the time for criminal actions in our county. That's part of how our criminal system works. If there is a warrant that is being issued by one of our local law enforcement, it will be served by local law enforcement, not a federal agent.
So this is honestly part of the reason that we need to be able to communicate with federal agencies. So if a federal agency, and this has happened, a federal agency calls us and says we have a federal warrant for this residence, we're looking for three people with federal warrants, whether they're here illegally or legally, we're going to assist them. That's a criminal action. But if it's an administrative immigration warrant, that comes on me to decide what we're going to do. If it's an administrative thing. Right now, they will call us and tell us. We will communicate with them so we know what's going on. But the most we will likely do is be down the street in communication with them just so we know when somebody calls 911, we know what's happening. And the sheriff and I are very much on the same page about this. We share our Gallatin County SWAT team. It's half members from my department, half from his. And so we talk about things and make sure we are on the same page about is it judicial, is it administrative, what are all the other variables, what are the consequences of not assisting and communicating. We take a lot of that stuff into account right now when we're determining the level of assistance.
Audrey, can I also ask, we have a lot of small business owners here as well. From the lens of a small business owner, how do those rates and protocols?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So where the legal landscape is right now is that if there is a public area, administrative warrants can be served. So, for example, if you have a business and there's a lobby, that's open to the public typically, an administrative warrant would likely be able to be served in that public lobby. If you have a door that says employees only, and there are employees back there, that's your workspace, that's probably a private area, in which case federal law enforcement officers would need a judicial warrant to get back into that area. So administrative warrants wouldn't allow those individuals to make it past that employees only door.
Thank you. This is a hot topic, but what are Gallatin County citizens' rights to film ICE and report it?
Yeah, that is a good question. So Montana and the Ninth Circuit have stated that it is acceptable to film any law enforcement officer when they're out doing their job. I think that's actually pretty clear. I think where it gets a little sticky is if there is a possibility of obstructing justice. And that is, I think, what Marcus and Chief Feldkamp were saying, that instead of attempting to intervene, calling 911 is the best bet.
Thank you. That's real clear. Honestly, I'm like, that was a really straightforward answer, and I really appreciate it. So this is a little bit more tricky, but does local government have any authority or avenues for advocacy to require clearer identification? I'm sorry, I'm ending on a hard one. I'm sorry,
You got it.
To require clear identification or proper uniforms for federal agents to just reduce the confusion and enhance.
Yeah, so this is tricky, right? Because we have our different levels of government, and the feds are kind of here at the top, right? And then we have our state, and then we have our county, and then we have our city. And the city can't tell the county what to do. The county can't tell the state what to do. The state can't tell the feds what to do, right? It's kind of the opposite. And so where this gets a little tricky is that this should be a congressional action. Congress should take action if they want their federal agents to abide by certain rules. Local governments can pass resolutions urging the state or the or Congress to do something about it, but it doesn't really have any notable effect except that, hey, we as a community believe that this is wrong and that you should do something about it. There are certain things that I think local governments can do, and, you know, I think it centers around what all of these panelists were saying, which are the public education and safety campaigns. I think learning how to verify law enforcement credentials, and we learned about that from Chief Elkamp tonight. I think, you know, we could, the community and maybe the county or the city or both, could perhaps explore some kind of memorandum of understanding with ICE, with Department of Homeland Security, so ICE and Border Patrol, to just verify, hey, if you're in our community and you have some kind of operation going on, we would like to know. I don't know how successful that would be. We have had memorandums of understanding with the federal government before, but certainly not in this capacity, to my knowledge.
Thank you, Audrey. That was a tough one, and I appreciate it. And not all these things are going to be clear answers, right, folks? And so I think that's the first step, is getting the most information, engaging with experts, having your voice heard, showing up. This is the change that we want to see, so I really appreciate it. Hold on one moment. We're going to open up to general questions. I just, for the panel, whoever can take this, but what's one myth we're hoping to bust tonight? Nobody wants to take this one. Yeah, I'm making us do one, but
can I just turn that around?
Yeah.
And I would be really curious as to what the community wants to see from the elected officials and leadership right now. I mean, what can we do to help?
We have a microphone here.